920 AM, W248 DE, Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Monica Ricks. The White House confirms President Biden will be the keynote speaker when the Democratic National Convention starts tomorrow in Chicago. Communications Director Ben LaBolt says Biden's not running anymore, but he's not going anywhere either.
He made a courageous decision to step aside in the name of party unity. He believes that the way to defeat Donald Trump is to ensure that the Democratic Party is unified. And after 4 weeks or so of the party fracturing, he didn't believe that was the way to move forward with the campaign.
Meantime, Republicans are urging former President Trump to stick to the issues as presidential polls start tightening up. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham was on NBC.
Donald Trump, the provocateur, the showman, may not win this election. So I'm looking for President Trump to show up in the last 80 days to define what he will do for our country.
Trump has repeatedly swerved from his focus on the economy to personal attacks against Vice President Harris. Ceasefire talks continue in the Middle East. Sebastian Ushers with the BBC.
I think the U.S. feels the stakes are so high this time with the threat of a regional all-out conflict potentially erupting after the killing of the Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Iran and the killing of a top Hezbollah military commander, that the ceasefire now for wider peace in the region is essential.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's one of several U.S. officials in Israel now for negotiations. He's set to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tomorrow. Across the Atlantic, a move to criminalize extreme misogyny.
Britain's powerful new interior minister, Yvette Cooper, has ordered a review of the UK's counter-extremism strategy to determine how best to tackle threats posed by harmful ideologies. And hatred of women is one of the ideological trends that the government says is gaining traction in Britain. The review will also consider the causes for the radicalization of young people, be it to far-right, Islamist, or so-called incel ideology.
That's CBS's Vicky Barker reporting. Ernesto's expected to become a hurricane again as it churns along the East Coast. National Weather Service meteorologist Zach Taylor's tracking it.
They actually stop at the border of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. So it looks like the current statements do cover up through the coast of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, but then aren't necessarily affect for the coastal portions of Maine.
At least one person's died in strong surf in North Carolina. And in Florida, the Python Challenge ends in a few hours. More than 600 hunters are in the Everglades right now, hoping to catch and kill the most pythons for a big cash prize. 200 giant snakes were caught last year.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
James here, host of Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape, every Sunday from 8 to 9 on WFHR. It's your weekly dose of music, nostalgia, and pop culture exclusively on locally grown radio.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new study from Georgetown University shows the best jobs in the future will go to the people with the highest degrees. Will Waukee reports.
Researchers found that 85% of good jobs will go to people with bachelor's degrees or other forms of post-secondary training by 2031. Report author Artem Gulish with the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce says even traditional blue-collar work, such as construction, will increasingly require apprenticeships or courses in fields like machinery and tech.
While those jobs are going to be growing, in part because of the infrastructure investments that the federal government and state governments have been making in recent years, those opportunities are going to be shifting to middle skills.
Gulish says a good job pays a minimum of $43,000 a year for workers between ages 25 and 44. He says over time it will be more challenging for those with only high school degrees to earn that salary. In general, college enrollment of young people is actually declining, especially among men. Gulish says the future labor market is not set in stone, especially as technologies such as artificial intelligence keep evolving. But having a post-secondary degree will often make you more employable.
The future does not look like the present, so having that ability to adapt and learn and upskill and reskill and pick up new skills will definitely be beneficial.
Georgetown's report found that there will be more good jobs on the market by 2031 compared to now. That's partly because policymakers are facing pressure to deliver higher job quality rather than just lower unemployment. I'm Will Walkie. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have mostly sunny skies on tap for your Sunday, and north winds up around 20 miles per hour, highs reaching near 80 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the lower 50s, upper 70s, and sunshine as we start your work week. Right now, it's 76.
Hey, it's producer Conrad. Pete will be back from vacation Monday with guests Rob Thomas and Bill Leff. The Democratic National Convention is next week, so join the Nightlight stream from 7 to 9 p.m. on Facebook, YouTube, or X.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on all of these wonderful broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Thank you so very much for joining me and my terrific producer, Max, as together we examine and explore the worlds of government, law, justice, and the promotion of the rule of law in our state, our nation, and across our planet. Delighted, as always, to have you being a part of our discussion on this weekly weekend venued broadcast. And you can do that. You can do that through a couple of different ways. One is by calling our number at 844-967-2789. That number, once again, is 844-967-2789. Max always reminds me that you can also jump on the Civic Media app and send us a question, send us an inquiry about the subject matters that we're discussing. We'll also take those and get answers right here on the air of the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted, once again, to have you with me for Amicus, a law review. We take our name, as always, our adopted commission to conduct a review and analysis, sometimes a deliberation, some consideration of the recent news events of our time in those all-important areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. We take our name from, yes, it's legal. Yes, it's Latin. It's ami, amicus, meaning a friend of the court, an individual or an organization that assists somehow in understanding, conveying some appreciation, offering some assessment of some relevant issues or questions that need resolution by our nation, our state, our communities. And so that's what we do here on this broadcast every single weekend as we undertake to not only inform and educate, but also engage in this all-important enterprise called civics education. And this weekend is no exception. As a part of our syllabus, this weekend on Amicus Law Review, lots of different things to address. Not all of it related to the United States Supreme Court. We have spent a lot of time in recent weeks reviewing those major decisions. They still have huge implications for other cases, other events going on out there in America, in other courts. And that's going to be our principal focus on our two-hour broadcast this weekend. That is, how are those cases impacting other court decisions? And knowing that the Supreme Court derives its docket, the cases it takes from around the country, from the lower courts, the appellate courts and the district courts, the trial courts in America, we're going to be spending some time, especially in our second hour, talking about some major things going on in the lower federal courts, the district courts, the appellate courts, in the areas of protests and access of all students on campuses here in our nation. We've got another Court of Appeals that has issued a major ruling having to do with the legitimacy, the constitutionality of semi-automatic rifles in America. We'll talk about that. We've got the Eighth Circuit issuing two opinions in different areas, one of them having to do with a book ban in Iowa. Major, major case coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And another decision also coming out of that same appellate court having to do with student loan relief as it is presented by the president's most recent invocation of his attempts to try to provide some loan relief to students and debtors throughout our nation. The appellate courts, the district courts of our nation, much engaged in activities, many of which subject matters, many of those may in fact end up in the United States Supreme Court. I'm going to take a look at some of those to give you some sampling, especially at a time when the United States Supreme Court is not issuing these major decisions. It did, however, just late this past week, issue a non-decision, if you will, decided not to take one of the package of cases coming out of a couple of appellate courts having to do with transgender rights. We've talked before about the interest of the Supreme Court in this coming term, 2024-2025, of the Supreme Court in the area of transgendered rights in terms of education and other opportunities out there. A major decision, kind of a non-decision, to decide not to review a lower court decision, actually two of them. And we're going to talk about that probably in our second hour as well. Lots of things going on at the appellate court and the trial court levels, including as well, just this past week, also in federal court, this major prosecution of the doctors and other assistants who were involved, according to the allegations, in this very significant omnibus criminal indictment involving the death last October of Matthew Perry. Look at some of the aspects of that major case and describe some of the things that the government has already set forth in the public record. Gives us some sense about what's going to happen in that trial as the case involving the death, the tragic, untimely death of Matthew Perry. We'll learn a little bit more about a drug called ketamine, which is the principal drug that resulted in his tragic and untimely death. We'll talk about what's going on in the federal district court. An indictment just this past week arising out of his death. As we begin, however, our analysis of all things government, law-related, rule of justice, other things in the areas of courts and matters involving all of us, we're going to begin to do, as we've done before, some trial updates when it comes to what's going on in those four cases, those four discrete but somewhat related cases involving our former president, a present candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. His name, of course, is Donald Trump. And there were two major developments in two different courts just this past week in those courts that are going to be affecting the scheduling, the proceedings of those cases, and making it very clear that September, yes, that's right, next month is going to be one of the most significant litigation-related months in our calendar year, right before the coming election in November, but also focusing on our attention on what's going on in these courts. Let's talk as we begin to think about these particular cases. What's happening? What's happening in that New York case? That's the so-called hush money, the false statements case that resulted in a jury verdict, 34 counts of violations of state law. Case being presided over by Judge Juan Merchan, engaged in a couple of important things this past week, announced a somewhat revised schedule, and also admonished defense counsel when it comes to some of the things that they have been doing in the past and now more recently. What did Judge Juan Merchan do in that case in the wake of the trial of Donald Trump, now completed, again, the jury verdict finding him guilty, felony counts there in the state of New York? This past week, the Judge Juan Merchan declined for, yes, a third time, three times, to step aside from the case based upon a motion filed by the defense on behalf of Donald Trump seeking to recuse him from that trial. In a three-page decision, remarkably small, the judge not giving this a whole lot of attention because he has given it attention before. In this very limited three-page decision, Judge Juan Merchan slammed the filing and said that it is rife with inaccuracies. It was repetitive, he said, and he dismissed the idea that he has had in the past, has now, any specific conflict of interest that would prevent him from going ahead in this case. The lawyers for Donald Trump had argued that the judge's daughter, remember this, had a long-standing relationship with Kamala Harris, a claim that her colleagues have roundly and clearly disputed, and cited also her work for some political campaigns as a Democratic consultant. Well, all of that opposed, of course, by the prosecution, who said none of that is true as a matter of fact, and also not a basis for recusing the judge. Judge Merchan had, in fact, gone to a committee on ethics there in New York, and that committee told him that its impartial ruling was that he could, in fact, reasonably remain on the case and that nothing about these supposed unsupported allegations justified his removal. And as a result of that, he has remained on the case. Again, this past week, Judge Juan Merchan, in responding to yet another request, repetition here, by the defense bar there, he said this. He said, stated plainly, defendants' arguments, he's talking there about Donald Trump, are nothing more than a repetition of stale and unsubstantiated claims. This is what the judge wrote in his limited ruling, underscoring his frustration with this process and asking the counsel, why is it that you continue to bring this up? He said that the petition now reiterates for yet a third time that which should already be clear. This is what Judge Merchan wrote. Innuendo and mischaracterizations, he said, do not create a conflict of interest. Recusal is therefore not necessary, much less required. And so the judge telling them in no uncertain terms that they should go away on this issue. We are done with it. At the same time, the judge reaffirmed his schedule, which is, again, making the month of September in New York. And yes, as we're going to talk in just a few moments, also in the District of Columbia, September is going to be the month here in the United States of America for movement on these two major cases. This one, a state criminal case pending in New York. September 16th, Judge Juan Merchan has decided to hold a hearing. And at that time, presumably, he is going to be announcing his decision on what to do about this late-related motion by the defense to seek the overturning, the vacation of the jury verdict based upon the immunity ruling of the United States Supreme Court. The defense maintaining that because the Supreme Court has wildly, unconstitutionally found that there is an immunity that attaches to presidents for criminal acts that they may commit while in the White House, notwithstanding the significant problems, the overwhelming problems with that opinion for our nation and for these particular cases, the judge nonetheless has scheduled a hearing on the motion that seeks to invoke that opinion and apply it to the New York case. There is no real application here. The matters involving this particular prosecution, most of them happened before the defendant was the president. Beyond that, the limited amount of information, the events happening during his presidency, very limited, unlikely, highly unlikely that Judge Merchan is going to find that Supreme Court ruling necessitates that he get rid of, that he dismiss the case pending before him. September 16th, the date he's going to announce his decision, almost certainly going to be rejecting that latest defense motion. And then he has also said that on September 18th, a couple of days later, he is going to be doing one of two things, either further proceedings as necessary based upon what he does on the 16th, or more likely sentencing former President Donald Trump for his convicted crimes there in New York, a major day in American history. September 18th, the judge is going to impose a sentence upon Donald Trump. He faces up to 4 years in prison for that offense conduct, could very likely receive a far shorter sentence, even probation, could involve some term of imprisonment, could involve fines, all sorts of things could happen here. The judge has great latitude to do what he wants. And so on September 18th, we're going to be hearing from the judge as he goes forward and makes those decisions. As we continue here on our broadcast, more about that and other cases in the courts of America.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Join our advertising family on WFHR and WIRI and see how radio can help improve awareness, revenue, and staffing for your business. I'm Ashley, and it's my mission to help our area businesses thrive. Call me today, 715-496-0710.
Unique farming operations need unique financial solutions. Ag Country Farm Credit Services offers customized financing that fits any size farm, ranch, or agribusiness. The next time you're in the market for more land, equipment, facilities, or maybe even an operating loan, contact the team at Ag Country. They know agriculture and will work for you. Ag Country. Focused on ag, focused on you. Egg Country is an equal opportunity lender.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones. Check 511WI.gov or download the app for road work or closures on your route. Know before you go with 511 Wisconsin, sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, and we are talking in these first segments of our weekend broadcast all about updates in those cases pending against Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, current candidate for the presidency of the United States of America, talking about the decisions just this past week by Juan Merchan to do a couple of things, actually several things, including scheduling a hearing on September 16th. For the purpose of announcing his resolution of these pretrial motions on this arguably frivolous request to dismiss the case based upon the immunity ruling, and also then scheduling a sentencing hearing for September 18th, a big day, a major day in American history, the first time in our history that a former president will be sentenced for criminal conduct in a state court. Beyond that, because the defense counsel, the defendant himself, has been unsuccessful in getting the judge to recuse himself, to postpone any of this. We got yet another motion late in this past week, again, of sort of the variety of things we have seen before. Donald Trump once again asking Judge Merchan yet again to delay the sentencing in this case until after November, after the presidential election. In a letter that was sent by the counsel for the former president, the attorneys for him say that this would amount to election interference to sentence the defendant, Donald Trump, 7 weeks before Election Day. The Trump lawyer, his name is Todd Blanche, you may recall him from the trial, said that a delay would also allow Mr. Trump time to weigh next steps after the trial judge rules on September 16th on those defense requests. Lots going on here. And says there's no basis for continuing to rush. Well, in fact, this case has been afforded an awful lot of time in terms of its pretrial attention, certainly its trial attention. The judge now moving ahead, as would a judge in any other criminal trial, state or federal in America. The defense, again, maintaining that an adjournment is necessary because the court would reduce by doing this, if not eliminate, any issues regarding the integrity of future proceedings. Highly unlikely that Judge Merchan is going to grant that motion, won in a series of just this past week, to further delay the proceedings. September 18th, a very major day in American history as Judge Juan Merchan almost certainly proceeds finally to sentencing. After that, of course, that's when the judgment in this case will be entered, a formal judgment based upon the jury verdict, based upon the things that the judge does at the time of the sentencing. Then it's all done at the trial court level, and that procedurally is when a defendant, in this case Donald Trump, can and certainly will appeal the judgment to the Court of Appeals in New York. It's a state court of appeals, could go up to the New York Supreme Court, arguably a basis for getting to the United States Supreme Court. That's a whole lot more tenuous. Unlikely that would happen. Unlikely that the Supreme Court would grant certiorari, a request to review that case, but we'll see what happens down the road. Months ahead, however, well into 2025, maybe even beyond, before all of that is disposed, coming out of that jury verdict of this past year. That's the New York case. That's the state criminal case. That one is finished or nearly finished when it comes to the trial and almost sentencing now, in about a month from now, there in New York, in Manhattan. There are other cases, as you know well, and also in one of those cases, a major development of just this past week. We've talked about this before. This is the federal election interference case. It is pending in the D.C. District Court. That's the trial court in the District of Columbia in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. We've heard a lot about her in the past, in recent times. She now has before her this obligation to try to figure out what it is the Supreme Court said in this case called Trump versus the United States, establishing for the first time in our nation's history, contrary to 238 years of tradition, judicial tradition, political tradition, government tradition, that a president does have certain kinds of immunities when it comes to conduct in the Oval Office. A stunning disposition by the Supreme Court there. Also note, as we have noted in the past, all of these major impediments to the very trial of that case, the four-count indictment pending against Donald Trump, that coming out of a federal grand jury there in the District of Columbia, many principles set forth in that stunning opinion by the Supreme Court, establishing absolute immunity for communications and engagements with the U.S. Department of Justice, a major change in the very way that government works between the units of the executive branch, creating this notion of presumptive immunities for all other official acts, and stunningly, again, requiring the prosecution disprove an impact on the executive, on the defendant, on the presidency, if the trial goes ahead. Almost impossible to do. The Supreme Court order further precludes trial inquiries into or even proof before the jury of a thing called motive. Why did you do this? Can't talk about that now, apparently, in the course of the upcoming trial. Motive is somewhat different from intent, but somewhat related to it. Purposes, goals. Well, the allegations in the indictment are that the motive, the purpose, the intent was to stay in power. The Supreme Court has said can't talk about those things as you go forward in this trial. The opinion from the Supreme Court also prohibits references or invocations of official acts, things for which presumably there is protection against criminal prosecution, in attempting to establish the criminal acts, the unofficial acts. How one does that, one does not know. Amy Coney Barrett scratching her head as well, even in her semi-concurrence, semi-dissent, saying you can't do that. That's not a part of our process. And finally, the Supreme Court also saying that the reliance on our traditional trappings, the judicial safeguards, the justice safeguards, things like grand jury protections and pretrial rulings and jury instructions and all sorts of evidentiary standards, all those things insufficient, the Supreme Court rules, to protect a presidential defendant. Why? Because the presidency has got to be muscular. It's got to be strong. It's got to be active and very vibrant. And as a result of that, not only the general immunity principles, but also the restrictions on the trial as it goes ahead, Tanya Chutkan has appropriately said, counsel on both sides, what do we do with this? What do we do with this trial? What is left of this trial after the Supreme Court has issued this major opinion on July 1? And so she has solicited from counsel for the prosecution. That's Jack Smith. He is the special counsel, and also counsel from the defense. Information about what they think she should do going forward. We know from our discussion just last week that the government requested additional time, basically because inside the Department of Justice, almost certainly, there's an awful lot of head scratching, of not downright disagreement about what all this means. What do we say to the trial court now once all of this has been done? And just this past week, Tanya Chutkan gave the government, and yes, indeed, the defense as well, works in both directions, gave them all additional time until the end of this month, August 30th, to get their memorandums in, their written statements about what should happen next. Tell me, she said, what I should do. Not that I have to follow exactly what you say, but give me your recommendations, your proposals for what should happen here. She's giving them now until the end of the month, and a delay in the previous deadline of August 9th. And then she's also scheduled a hearing on September 5th. Again, making September a very important month, a September 5th hearing for the purposes of hearing about all this. Let's talk about all this. Let's figure out what's going to happen, and let's figure out what the impact of that decision is on this trial going ahead. After that, presumably Judge Chutkan obliged to review this 45-page indictment accusing Donald Trump of plotting to overturn the results of the 2020 election and figuring out now, in the wake of that momentous and catastrophic decision by the Supreme Court, what do you do? How do you handle a trial going ahead when you've established these major immunities? Is there anything left? That's the big question. And if so, what is that? And how do I go about proceeding, she's asking. All of that going to be the subject of inquiry coming up again in August and September of this year as we continue here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
CBS News Brief. President Biden will speak at the DNC tomorrow in Chicago and help rally the party around Vice President Harris. White House Communications Director Ben LeBolt.
Vice President Harris has been his governing partner for the last 4 years. She's been the decision maker who sits with him at the end of meetings and makes big decisions, and they've achieved incredible things together.
Republicans are urging former President Trump to stick to the issues while stumping this weekend. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham talked about it on NBC.
Every day we're not talking about her policy choices as vice president and what she would do as president is a good day for her and a bad day for us.
Ceasefire talks are seemingly at a stalemate as U.S. officials arrive in Israel for more negotiations. Jenny Hills with the BBC.
U.S. and Israeli officials have expressed optimism that a deal can be struck. But Hamas has dismissed that as an illusion. A senior official told the BBC that no progress had been made.
CBS News Brief. I'm Monica Ricks.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Another win for the Brewers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers' Freddy Peralta went six innings and got the win. Devin Williams came in the ninth and earned another save. And William Contreras with a home run as the Brewers beat the Guardians 2-1 last night at AmFam Field. Milwaukee now with a 10-game lead ahead of the Cardinals, who beat the Dodgers 5-2 in St. Louis. The Cubs with a 3-2 win over the Blue Jays at Wrigley. Brewers GM Matt Arnold giving reporters an update on Christian Yelich, saying when weeks of rehab failed, back surgery was their only option.
I can tell you he was in a lot of pain. He had shooting pains through his leg and his back, and he was trying like crazy to come back, and he's worked incredibly hard. And unfortunately, that procedure just wasn't working for him, and so he opted to have the procedure.
NFL, it's the Packers and Broncos tonight in their second preseason game. Jordan Love will not play, so you'll see second-year man Sean Clifford at quarterback, followed by seventh-round pick Michael Pratt out of Tulane running the offense in the second half. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have mostly sunny skies on tap for your Sunday, and north winds up around 20 miles per hour, highs reaching near 80 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the lower 50s, upper 70s, and sunshine as we start your work week. It's 78 at our studios.
CapTime's Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
Most of us can agree everyone deserves the right to make their own medical decisions. Politicians should have no say at all. Thankfully, we have leaders like Vice President Kamala Harris who are standing up for our rights to make our own medical decisions and protect abortion rights. As Vice President, Kamala Harris helped lead the administration's efforts to protect abortion rights after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Vice President Harris has worked to defend access to emergency medical care and support the ability to travel for reproductive care. She's fought for access to high-quality, affordable contraception and strengthened reproductive health privacy. Vice President Harris has defended our rights and freedoms against right-wing extremists who want the government to make medical decisions for us. She's a champion for our rights.
Visit www.abwt.org/Kamala and tell Vice President Harris, keep fighting for our freedom to make our own medical decisions. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
Dynamite! Do you catch yourself quoting TV shows like that? It could win you a free meal and make you our next star of the day with Culver's. Join the morning show on WFHR every Friday.
What you talking about, Willis?
My name's James, and I'm telling people every Friday we'll play a theme song or a quote from a movie.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give it.
You call 424-2600, give the correct answer, and you'll win a family pack from our Wisconsin Rapids Culver's.
To the Batmobile.
Join the morning show every Friday for Culver's Star of the Day.
I love it when a plan comes together.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, this is Aaron, Todd's producer. Todd's in Chicago getting ready to cover the Democratic National Convention. So on our next show, tune in for coverage of the event.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me on your broadcast station of Civic Media. Appreciate, as always, your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Also, you can drop us a note, an inquiry on the Civic Media app. Appreciate especially the comments, noting this weekend that Sherry from Horicon has written in and said to Max and me that she appreciates the show and looks forward to it. And we appreciate our listeners and look forward to your participation as well. Sherry, thank you for that comment. And thank you, all of you, for engaging with me and Max in our discussion of all things justice, all things rule of law related. Let's continue in our assessment, our fairly regular inventory now, what's going on in those court cases involving Donald Trump. We've talked about Judge Juan Merchan. We've talked about Judge Tanya Chutkan, the things that they've done just this past week to make clear that September, the month of September 2024, going to be a major, major month, certainly in this campaign cycle, when it comes to the disposition or partial disposition, at least the movement forward of these two cases, one federal, one state, pending against Donald Trump, both criminal cases in very different statuses. One, the result of a jury verdict heading towards sentencing. The other, nowhere near a jury verdict, nowhere near a trial yet. And that leads us to some assessment of those other cases also pending against Donald Trump, the Mar-a-Lago documents case. That is also a federal case coming out of South Florida, a federal grand jury there indicting Donald Trump for hoarding national security secrets, taking those documents with him when he left the White House at the end of his term. And right now, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta is reviewing whether or not the decision by Judge Eileen Cannon, she also was a federal district court judge there in Fort Pierce, she made the decision to dismiss the entire case, finding, again, stunningly, without much support at all, contrary to an awful lot of precedent out there, including precedent from the United States Supreme Court, Nixon versus United States back in 1974, basically rejecting all that, saying, nope, I think the special counsel here has no authority to prosecute this case there. I'm dismissing the entire thing. That question is now up before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, the appellate court. That's a federal appellate court, again, in that part of our country. And according to their routine briefing schedule that would be established by that court, we've got a ways to go before even all the briefing, the pre-argument briefing, is done. Judge Cannon threw out the case on July 15th, and again, it's highly likely that the opening brief by the petitioning party, in this case, the one who is contesting that dismissal of the case, that's Jack Smith, that's the government, that's the U.S. Department of Justice, probably has to file an opening brief in late August, just a couple of weeks here in this month. Then Donald Trump and his attorneys, part of the process, have an opportunity about 30 days after that to respond again in writing. And after that, Jack Smith gets another opportunity a couple of weeks after that to submit a reply brief. And then after all of that, the Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals there in Atlanta, will probably schedule oral argument maybe later this calendar year, perhaps sometime in 2025. And we'll resolve that issue. Highly likely, once again, it will overturn Judge Cannon on this baseless and unprecedented decision she made. Question is, how will it do that? It will obviously have to wrestle with the arguments presented by defense counsel that what Judge Eileen Cannon did was legitimate and right. The government maintaining just the opposite based upon all that precedent, all of the long-standing rule of law in our nation that says, no, this is exactly how you can do it. Number of things could happen in the wake of that decision from the 11th Circuit. Goes back to a district court judge for more pretrial proceedings. No trial date again scheduled in this at all. The question is whether or not it would go back to Eileen Cannon. Appeals courts have some authority in that area. The government, through Jack Smith, has not specifically requested that it be reassigned. A petition, a request that he could make if indeed and when the United States Court of Appeals returns that to a district court. Right now, no end in sight. Sometime 2025, presumably, the appellate court rules on whether or not Eileen Cannon was right or wrong, more likely wrong, in dismissing that case. And then, of course, we have that fourth case. That's the case pending in Georgia. This is the Fannie Willis prosecution. It was initiated a year ago this past week. That's how long it has been. Again, a nearly 100-page long indictment. You recall it well. 41 criminal counts against Donald Trump and 18 other people, other high-profile people charged in that case, along with the former president, include people like the White House chief of staff, his name, Mark Meadows. He also has other problems in other jurisdictions around the country. Former New York City mayor and frequently advisor to the former president, Rudy Giuliani, also has his bankruptcy woes. He's got counsel woes. He's got all kinds of problems, including other criminal exposure charge in that case as well, along with attorney Sidney Powell. Now, there have been some results coming out of that case. All of the defendants charged with violating the state's anti-racketeering law. You may recall that well as we discussed this broad, very lengthy, sweeping indictment there in Georgia. 161 alleged acts to support this basic charge of violating the state's anti-racketeering law. And it also goes on to note significantly that the false electors scheme, a part of the indictment here there in Georgia as well. All of this pending again previously in front of Scott McAfee. That judge overseeing the case there in March dismissed six of those counts, saying that they had not properly provided enough detail to the defense. A requirement of the law, you got to provide detailed information, put the defendant on notice of what he or she is advised of as charged with, and so you can advise them of what the charges are and they can prepare an appropriate defense. The judge had dismissed six of those counts. Willis's team is appealing that ruling. And of course, the other one that you recall well is that the defense is also appealing Judge McAfee's decision not to find that Fani Willis has a conflict of interest that warrants her removal from that case. That now also up in the Court of Appeals at the Georgia appellate level. All of that now suspending any further movement forward in that Georgia case. We know as well that two other significant aspects. We know some people already pled guilty. We know that there's a bail bondsman named Scott Hall. He had previously pleaded guilty to some misdemeanor charges in that case back in the early portion of last year. In addition, Sidney Powell and another lawyer, Kenneth Chesbro, each pleaded guilty. And other matters out there moving towards some disposition. Jenna Ellis, also a vocal part of Trump's reelection campaign, also entered a guilty plea. So some defendants pleading guilty already. But with respect to the great majority of them, including the former president, no movement forward on that case. And even when it comes back, clearly, defense counsel is going to raise once again, as they have in the New York case, as they have in the federal case in Washington, D.C., this question of immunity. Does a defendant like Donald Trump, is he entitled to the protection of that stunningly wrong Supreme Court case, finding that presidents are immune from certain kinds of prosecutions for their criminal acts? How does that apply to the Georgia case? The same kind of argument being made in all these different forums. So when that case comes back from the appellate court there in Georgia, more for the district court judge there, Scott McAfee, to address. Lots of things going to happen there as well, well into 2025. No trial date there either. That's our assessment. That's our inventory, as we often do here on our weekend broadcast, of all the criminal trials going ahead. A footnote to the Georgia prosecution, in particular, another event that happened, especially as we think about the elections here in Wisconsin just this past week or so. Interestingly involving one of the players, not a defendant, actually a defender, if you will, of voting processes. His name is Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. Remember him? According to the allegations in that indictment in Georgia, the defendant, Donald Trump, called him up and said, I need enough votes to make certain that I get the entire electoral package coming out of Georgia. That's his part in all of this. He declines to go along with that by the president many, many, many months ago. And that event, however, becomes a part of the indictment against Donald Trump and the others. A bit of news coming out of the Secretary of State's office in connection with that just this past week. Secretary of State coming out strongly against a rule change. It's pending before a state entity called the State Election Board there. And the Secretary of State specifically rejecting a proposal, get this, to count ballots by hand at polling places on election night. What's this all about? At a meeting in July, that board had moved forward a proposal presented to it that would require three separate poll workers to count ballots at voting precincts on election night to make sure that they match the number of ballots received by the voting machines. In other words, look at the electronics, look at your hand counts. And this proposal for hand counting involving these three separate poll workers, further delaying certainly the counting of votes there, all of that, a part of this proposal, is open for public comment right now. And that is what prompts Brad Raffensperger to say this is misguided. That's a gentle and diplomatic way of saying he doesn't believe it's in any way promoting the interests of a fair and free election. He says it would delay the reporting of election results, introduce risks to chain of custody procedures. Went on to say activists seeking to impose last-minute changes in election procedures outside of the legislative process undermine voter confidence and burden election workers. Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State responsible for overseeing there in Georgia the overall elections, the polling processes, he coming out strongly in opposition to this very much unsupported notion that we need now to have hand counting of polls on election night. Three separate poll workers doing a redundant and a secondary review somehow to indicate that the polling, the numeric counting is accurate. Brad Raffensperger and everyone else looking at this reasonably rationally saying no need to do this would certainly slow down the process. But again, a connection to all of this coming out of voting in Georgia. And of course, all of this a part of our overall review of the 2020 election and elections, even as we go forward into November of this year, when we once again are going to be electing a president and other representatives at our state and federal levels as well, local levels too. All of that happening in and outside our courts. Another significant thing happening just this past week. And it is tragic. It is one of those things that we look to and shake our heads in disbelief as a nation, as people of this nation who care about other human beings. Just this past week, we are reminded of the tragic death of Matthew Perry, who played, of course, Chandler Bing on Friends for many years on NBC. He was found dead on October 28th, floating face down in a hot tub at his home in Los Angeles there. Plainly the victim of a drug overdose. And we're hearing just this past week, confirmation just this past week, of five different people having been charged with conspiracy to distribute a powerful anesthetic called ketamine. Ketamine that, according to the allegations in this indictment, led to that tragic, horrific death of Matthew Perry. Three of them are pleading guilty, others of them proceeding, at least at this point, going to trial. What do we know about all of this? Well, we know that based upon what's coming out of the Central District of California, again, this is another federal case. It has not yet been tried. Right now, we simply have the allegations coming out of a grand jury. Again, a grand jury, 26 people brought together to determine whether or not there's probable cause to charge individuals, in this case, two doctors, a personal assistant, and some others with these crimes. A grand jury returned this indictment in the Central District of California. That's a federal circuit there in the state of California. Prosecutors saying that Mr. Perry's assistant and an acquaintance had worked with two doctors and a drug dealer to procure tens of thousands of dollars worth of ketamine for Matthew Perry, who has admitted in his own memoir and other circumstances, a long struggled with substance abuse and addiction and perhaps other challenges. We know as well that this indictment was filed in federal court just this past week. Details with great specificity charges against Jasveen Senga, who prosecutors described as the ketamine queen, and Dr. Salvador Plasencia, who is also known as Dr. P. All of that coming out of this major prosecution now in the wake of the tragic death of Matthew Perry back in October of last year. We're going to talk more about what that indictment says, that talking indictment, some of the things that underscore the nature of what happened here. We always move forward and say that defendants, of course, presumption of innocence, even as these charges go forward. We'll talk more about them as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids' home of Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Over the past 20 years, Wisconsin has seen a huge increase in reported elder abuse cases. Elder abuse is the verbal, physical, emotional, sexual, or financial abuse of a senior citizen. It can also be the intentional or unintentional neglect of an older person. Wisconsin's population of seniors 65 and older is projected to grow significantly in the coming decades. That's why we all share the responsibility to help protect our seniors by recognizing and reporting any signs of elder abuse. If you believe that elder abuse has been inflicted upon yourself or someone you know, please report it. Call the Wisconsin Elder Abuse Hotline toll-free at 1-833-586-0107 or visit reportelderabusewi.org. Respect our elders. Report abuse. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Justice.
This project is supported by the Administration for Community Living, ACL, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, as part of a financial assistance award totaling $120,000 with 100% funding by ACL HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of nor an endorsement by ACL HHS or the U.S. government.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. In this, our final segment of our first hour here on the weekend, we're talking about the tragic death of Matthew Perry back in October of last year. And in the wake of that, plainly an investigation by state and federal authorities of what happened here, resulting ultimately in the grand jury there in California returning an indictment against five people. Among other things, the so-called talking indictment and other documents released by the prosecution into the public domain paint a picture about the terrible behavior, the intentional behavior, which is what we'll talk about, by these defendants. The court documents show that Mr. Perry's personal assistant, a fellow named Kenneth Iwamasa, injected him with at least 27 shots of ketamine in the 5 days leading up to his death, including at least three on the very day that Matthew Perry died. This indictment said that these defendants had used coded language, discussed drug deals among themselves, referring to bottles of ketamine as Dr. Pepper or cans and bots, said that when Dr. Plasencia texted with another doctor about how much to charge Matthew Perry for this ketamine, he wrote, "I wonder how much this moron will pay. Let's find out." Now, the reason why that is significant is that it is unusual to charge doctors with this kind of criminal behavior. But here plainly, what distinguishes negligence from criminal conduct is, of course, intent. And that kind of a statement, that kind of a statement reflecting that the doctors here, the participants in this conspiracy, intended to get money out of this without any concern for the patient, Matthew Perry himself. Wonder how much this moron will pay. Let's find out. Those kinds of statements establishing what we call criminal intent. We've sometimes described it as mens rea. That's the law school. That's the legal term that indicates that before you can charge, before you can prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, need to show that they intended the results of their conduct. And here, that, among other things already released in the public domain, paint a picture of a very strong case by these five people. Ketamine, we know, is a powerful anesthetic. It's got some psychedelic properties. It's increasingly being used as an alternative therapy for depression and anxiety and other mental health problems. And it is also used and abused recreationally. And that's part of the problem here, undeniably. That is it. Now, three of these five have already pled guilty. Iwamasa has pled guilty to one count of conspiracy. Dr. Mark Chavez, who's admitting to selling the ketamine to Dr. Plasencia, also pleaded guilty to conspiracy. A fellow named Eric Fleming, an acquaintance of Matthew Perry, pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy as well to distribute ketamine. Those three pleading guilty for their involvement, certainly also going to be providing testimony in any trial coming up with respect to the others in this case. Prosecutors have announced that Sanga and Plasencia have been arraigned, pleaded not guilty, which is their constitutional right to do. A judge has ordered Sanga jailed without bond, in custody, given the serious nature of all this that's happening. Plasencia's bond is $100,000. Trials are scheduled for October, not an especially long pretrial period here. And again, these folks face up to 15 years in prison, 25 years in prison, all this kind of thing under federal law for doing exactly what is charged in the indictment. Again, we always underscore the notion that defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. Unanimous juries have got to come back and do and find that the charges set forth in the indictment are in fact supported by the evidence. Plasencia accused in the indictment of misleading officials in addition to the underlying conduct about Perry's treatment. Prosecutors saying that he had provided a falsified document purportedly showing that medical treatment plan for the victim was legitimate, claimed that he was being given a maximum dose of 60 milligrams over 24 hours. In fact, as the defendant, in this case Plasencia, knew well then at that time, again, here is the intent portion of this is why this is so very important to understand in terms of the movement forward against doctors on a criminal basis. Defendant knew that the injections into Matthew Perry with these ketamine doses far exceeded 60 milligrams, in fact, dramatically beyond that. In the weeks leading to Matthew Perry's death, according to the indictment, again, this talking indictment that we now have access to, the law enforcement authorities said that Plasencia sold roughly $55,000 worth of ketamine to Mr. Iwamasa, who again is the personal assistant, personally injected Matthew Perry with the drug at Perry's residence during one of those visits. Tragically, large dose caused Matthew Perry to freeze up and causing the doctor to advise against a similarly sized injection in the future. In other words, a bad reaction in one instance. Plasencia also injected Perry with ketamine inside a vehicle in a public parking lot in Long Beach, California. Again, all of this according to the allegations in these complaints. Doctors charged Perry $2,000 for a vial of ketamine that cost Chavez roughly $12. Other documents released as a part of this also reveal other things related to the time right before Matthew Perry's death in all of these proceedings. One of them, a mutual friend of Mr. Perry, texted him offering to sell ketamine for a good price as long as he received a fair tip for bringing it in. This particular person, Fleming, told Iwamasa that his source, Sanga, had dealt with high-end celebrities. Fleming texting Iwamasa, "I guarantee it's going to be amazing." And again, all of that set forth in the indictment, in these public documents, to establish once again this fundamental notion that this was not inadvertent. This was not a drug overdose of the sort that we sometimes so tragically see in America, including with people of notoriety, but with an awful lot of people. Awful lot of people in other circumstances. We've commented here on this broadcast about the impacts of the opioid crisis and the recent Supreme Court case rejecting a bankruptcy plan that would have placed recovery monies in the hands of victims. All of that kind of thing, it is absolutely tragic. And we recognize the tragic nature of all of that. Here, you've got something much more than just inadvertence and addiction. You have got an intentional, purposeful design by these individuals, money related, financially related, wanting to do this for the purpose of gaining money and also plainly disregarding the legitimate interests of their patient, in this case, Matthew Perry. All that coming out of the Central District of California, trial set for October. More attention to that among other cases as we go forward. All of that, once again, a part of our normal process, a part of our process here in our nation, there in California. This, once again, a federal district court ruling coming out of the District of Central California, the decision, if you will, by the grand jury there to return charges. More on that in future broadcasts here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we're in Milwaukee getting set to board the train as we preview this week's Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning starting at 6.
The Democratic National Convention is in Chicago, and our team will be there to tell you what you need to know.
I'm Civic Media News Director Terry Bell.
And I'm Todd Allball, host of the Todd Allball Show. Count on us for important analysis, interviews, and the Democrats' nomination of their presidential candidate.
Live from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Listen for updates, plus special coverage at 6 each night. Find it on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram. This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.